This is Melissa, and today is the 20th of May, 2025, and this is just a short little prologue to the already recorded book club discussion that we had a few weeks ago on Telegram, and that was the kickoff recording for Waiting for the Miracle. Waiting for the Miracle is the transcript book form of the interviews that Alan Watt had with Jackie Patru on Sweet Liberty between 1998 and the year 2000. And there were 24 in total of those interviews. And Alan, for a while, sold them as cassette tapes, and then eventually he offered them for sale as CDs. And then later on, back in 2007, I transcribed them into book form, and Alan made an introduction, and that became Waiting for the Miracle. So that is what we're discussing in Telegram. And I know that some of you are following along in Telegram in the group with us, and some of you are reading and you're not in Telegram. And so I want to make this clear and available, but also to let you know what is going on and the schedule that we're keeping. After trying a couple of different things, we have settled on, we'll have 2 weeks of unrecorded discussion in Telegram. Every Saturday we meet at noon Eastern Standard Time for about an hour and a half. And we're discussing syllabus material, which are all the little extras that I put together with Laura, who is part of Book Club. And there's a lot there. The syllabus is dense, and also people are contributing to that with their own extras. So we want to talk about the pyramids and Sumer. And Alan talks about some of these things on his audios. And we've also attached PDFs of books or links to PDFs that you can find for yourself. So it's turning out to be the kickoff of what promises to be several months of good discussion about this material. So that is the schedule. Saturday, this upcoming, the 24th, we'll be meeting again for a recorded session in which we'll be discussing, that will be Graham and myself discussing interview 3, which I've entitled Ancient Priests, and interview 4, A Contest Since the World Began. And then on the 31st and the 7th of June, we will discuss the syllabus material for interview 5, 12 Wise Men, and interview 6, Cain, Canaanite, and Khazar. And on the 14th of June, Nick Hayes will be leading that discussion by presenting the material, and then we'll talk about it after that, and that will be recorded. And then we'll have 2 more weeks of unrecorded discussion for parts 7 and 8, and then Neil Foster will do the recording on that. And that's just that letting you know about Neil is because he will not be attending the Telegram discussions, whether they are unrecorded or not, because Saturday is a big day for what he does in his work, and so he can't make it there. So I will take what he pre-records and bring it to the group, and we'll listen to it and then discuss it. So there are ways to participate, but that gets me down to what I have done next, or most recently, which was last night. And that was creating a Substack. So you can now start to find things over at cuttingthroughthematrix.substack.com. And a few people had suggested to me over a long time that I do something at Substack. So, you know, for a variety of reasons, that there's some flexibility there. It would also allow me to have a paid subscriber portion of it, so there'd be extras. Well, as I got more and more involved into preparing this material in the syllabus, I asked myself a question that I've often asked myself in the last 4+ years. What would Alan do? This material, Alan never made freely available. The books, of course, were always for sale, and this was, you know, how he kept the roof over the head and food on the table. but he never made those audios freely available. As you know, there are thousands of audios available for free download. You can also purchase them. You can purchase them in CD form, and now I've made them available as Pretty Flash Drives. But these 24 interviews were always a paid thing on the website, first as cassette tapes and then as CDs. And the reason why is because Alan felt that the material contained in these 24 interviews in the book form as well. It's really dense material for a serious student. And he, I think, just wanted to challenge people to go the extra step by actually paying for the material. And so that's how he proceeded. And as when I started this out, I was thinking about doing it as I had done Tragedy and Hope, which is just make the video of the recorded discussion and then put it up for free everywhere on all of the video channels that I've created, and as well to make it available in audio form on the websites. But, you know, the time just kept going by and I kept thinking, is that really what I want to do? And as it turns out, it isn't what I want to do. Eventually, I can put these together the way Alan did with those interviews. I can put together all of our discussions on the material and offer them to you as CDs or on a cheapo flash drive, you know, so that it's, you know, you're taking the extra step. It's not a get-rich scheme for me. It's just, it's in keeping with what the way that Alan did it. And I feel good about that. So going forward, you'll get this one today. I will put everywhere. That is part one of the book, the introduction, and interview one and two as discussed by myself and others in the book club group. And I'm linking to the syllabus, and I will link for you to the new Substack site. And I encourage you to go over there to Substack and subscribe. And I'm always going to do my best as I build this new site to offer things that are not just for paid subscribers. And I even said in the article that I posted last night that maybe even not sure we'll hit you right over there and there'll be some pieces posted there. But I'll try to add things that have value and interest, whether you are paying for a subscription or you have a free subscription. But it does allow me to have a paywall, which I would not be able to create on the website. I don't have that kind of technical know-how. And so it allows me to have a place where there are things just for paid subscribers. So it's a new thing. It's a new thing for me, but it's very much in the spirit of the way that Alan handled the material that was in what he called ancient religions, ancient history CDs. There were two of them, and that then became Waiting for the Miracle. So without further, here is that discussion for you. And I hope that you can join us in Telegram on the 24th when we get into the next two interviews. And I will, you know, keep bringing as much of this as I can to you free, including, you know, republishing the syllabus and mentioning it from time to time where we are. And I will continue to probably for the foreseeable future be picking redux that kind of tie in with conversations that we are having over on Book Club. So please don't feel left out. It's just a way of doing this. And like I said, come late this fall, I will probably offer all of the discussions. I think in total we'll have about 12 of them in some form that you can pick them up all at once and have those as part of your library of essentials. So thanks again. Take care.
All right. Well, listen, everybody, sorry for the delay and welcome to Book Club. And this is our first recorded conversation about it. And I want to get a little bit of housekeeping out of the way. What we'll do here is aim to have a recording that goes no longer than an hour and a half. We just got the syllabus published, and that was the first part. So that's 12 interviews, and Laura helped me with that. And I think it's really a good addition to the material. And just to give you an idea of what is contained in that, and that has been already posted on the Telegram site, and I'll be posting it on the website soon. But this is a syllabus, so it's extra material that goes along to contribute to our understanding and the context of what Alan and Jackie are talking about. And so what we have done is highlight some names that might be worth checking out. So in part one, interview one, that might be Noah Kramer, who wrote History Begins at Sumer, or Michael Cremo, who wrote Forbidden Archaeology. And in interview two, you've got Zechariah Sitchin, Charles Darwin, Cecil Rhodes. So you get the idea there with highlighting names. And then there's the inclusion of some extra material, like even links to where you'll find PDF copies of books or YouTube videos that might contribute to your understanding. That is kind of the setup for it. It is a smaller window than what we've done. And so I see that Nick is here, and we're kind of like long form people who want to talk a lot about the material. So this is a challenge to for whoever is presenting it. If it's one of us, in this case today, it is me, or if it's a couple of us working together on a presentation, I think we have an hour or under, say 45 minutes to an hour, to present the material, and then there's some time there for group discussion. Is there anything else on house cleaning that I'm missing? Let me think about that. So I think that that is it. The syllabus has been published. It will be published again. I'm creating a schedule. I think that Nick was going to do, he volunteered to do a section. Neil Foster can't be joining us on Saturday because he has his booth for jewelry sales open. But so that's where we stand now, and I'm welcome to chat with anyone about this, or if there's somebody else that you want to pair up with in the group, that is fine too. So that's where we go. So I want to just dive right in now, since I've got my 4 minutes of housekeeping out of the way. I received a card several months back from Prince, who I've done a couple of real histories with. And he sends, I call them letters, but they're really just a couple of notes, a few lines on a card. And he said, "Please do book club on Alan books. Everybody should read his books first, The Way Shower." And I agreed. I thought, yeah, that's a really good idea. Now, you'll notice as we go along and waiting for the miracle that it was Jackie Petrou who gave Alan the idea to write books. She said, "Alan, you should write a book about this." And he said, "No, I'm not going to do that." He just dismissed it immediately. So these interviews between Jackie Petrou on Sweet Liberty and Alan Watt that we're covering in this book started in 1998 and went to the year 2000. And sure enough, Alan started working on his Cutting Through books in 1999. And he ended up doing the third volume. I believe that was 2003. So he was busy writing, but I thought, well, if we're going to cover his material, let's start with Waiting for the Miracle, because this is really kind of the beginning of how his other books came to be. And one little thing there, before I met Alan, he asked me if I would be interested in transcribing the audio CDs into book form. And I said, absolutely. And that was really the beginning of everything for me, the whole life-changing thing, because, I took advantage of the fact that I had to email him all the time with questions. I know this crazy to think, but in 2007, we didn't all just go run look something up online. Yes, we had an internet, but we'd find other ways of having our questions answered. And there were things when I was listening, and those of you who have listened to the audio form of this know how hard it can be to make things out. And if I couldn't understand something, I would email and say, what did you mean by this? And there are some funny examples of it, because he was talking about the Firth of Forth, and Firth is how the Scottish and maybe other parts of Great Britain talk about their water inlets is a firth, and the fourth, I was spelling like the number fourth, but it's like go forth. So, you know, I was like, well, what do you mean here? And finally, at a certain point with in my questions via email, he said, well, we should just talk on the phone. We hadn't spoken before when then I was working on these. And so that's really how my relationship with Alan began, was by lots of questions and lots of hours spent on the phone. And so I am taking ashamed credit for the typos. And one more little personal aside here, you know, Alan was so big on personal responsibility, and he'd say, you know, every little mistake snowballs. And, you know, so he didn't actually read Waiting for the Miracle when I got done transcribing it. And I look now and I think, oh, just little things. And I'm making notes as I go. So, for instance, Jackie said that Michael Cremo wrote the book, The Secret Archaeology, and the book is actually Forbidden Archaeology. And I should have parenthetically noted that, but I didn't. And there's lots of those examples. So that's, there you go. One day, maybe there'll be a version of the book released with no typos in it. We can hope. So Prince had this idea, and I was going to do the first recording with Prince. And in fact, he is here with me today in spirit, because I ended up having a conversation with him early last week, I think, or the week before that. And we talked for about an hour and a half, and I asked him questions on the material that we're covering. But he had said, I thought he was averse and unwilling to participate on the Telegram site, social media, coming off your phone and all that. But it turned out that he didn't want to record anymore at all in any context. Real history is nothing. And he just said, you know, the computer is a tool. It runs counter to being an individual. I don't want to use it if I don't have to. And, you know, it sets my precedent for being an individual. I don't want to be like everyone else. I just want to have the conversation with you. And I respect individuals who know what they want, and I did not try to talk him out of that. So we ended up talking through the intro and the first two interviews, and I took notes, and I'm going to weave some of that into this presentation. So finally, in 2007, when I was working on the transcription, Alan came up with an introduction to it. So the interviews again between 1998 and 2000, and then he wrote this introduction as I was doing the transcription. And the introduction itself is just amazing. It was Charton Tinker in the group who described it as a pyramid, you know, or the upside. It's really Alan's bird's eye view at the top, and so much he's giving us, because he really, even in the introduction, is showing us a system that is all encompassing. And so just to read a couple of lines here, he said, these programs were an introduction into the origins of religion in ancient times, the histories of the peoples who brought forth these religions, and also to show you a system, not of all things, that appeared many thousands of years ago, undoubtedly having understood the science of the creating of what they call civilization, which is priesthood, money, merchandising, and bureaucratic systems comprised of different tiers of priests who overran and overruled these systems, beginning with Sumer and even touching on what we know of civilizations even further back. These programs were also done as a form of deprogramming, very gradual deprogramming, to an audience who swallowed reality as it had been presented to them from childhood and then was further augmented by the psychic driving systems of school and media. I knew when I went into it initially that I was going into a primarily Christian-oriented audience who had had that augmented by their country system, which is not theirs. Of course, there is a system all right, but it's not run by the people. It's just that the people didn't know that. They really believed that their lives were evolving, and so were those of the politicians. Things just happened coincidentally, and politicians blundered their way through things as men tend to do. Nothing really is further from the truth. So on these programs, you will hear much about Christianity, and you will also hear the gradual exposé of how Christianity itself was a fundamental tool of bringing in a couple of thousand years of someone else's agenda. So I said to Prince, Alan said that Christianity itself was a fundamental tool of bringing in a couple of thousand years of someone else's agenda. What do you think about that? And Prince said, at one time, Christianity had to be a good thing. Alan said, everything that starts out good becomes corrupt. It was the first time that anyone came out with something good for the people. And I'll just put in as an aside that I have been playing some things in the Redux, and Andrea has also been posting some things on the channel that are from the syllabus, like Man in the Mirror talk, or some things that I posted last week and the week before that I felt tied in with what we're talking about. And in last week's Redux, the date of which has slipped my mind at this very moment, but Alan was talking about the Buddha and how really what we know of his teachings was put down by his disciples, much in the same way that what we get of Christianity was put down by the followers of Jesus. So he said it's just it's never enough for people to hear, you know, some good ideas about how they ought to live in this world or what might be good for this world. They just want more. They keep wanting more. And so, again, that point that Prince makes, that everything that starts out good becomes corrupt. And this is one thing that Alan walks this tightrope with religion, because he understands very deeply, profoundly, with many years of research, how these religions are created down through time. And yet he also sees good in them. And as he was fond of saying, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. So Alan had, you know, said, man did not begin at Sumer, at least civilization did not begin at Sumer. They would love us to believe so, but Sumer emerged on the scene thousands of years BC as a fully fledged system, meaning the techniques of that system had to have been worked out in a previous civilization. And Prince said, when we were discussing this, ain't nothing new under the sun. How long has the sun been around? He's right. Alan's right. This has been going on since the beginning of time. Nobody knows how long, except the intelligence behind this knows. And one of the things that Alan talks to Jackie about in that section about Sumer is that what has been uncovered, what can be seen, what can be deciphered from the tablets, is that there was a fully fledged system. There was a bureaucratic class. They had techniques that they were describing for managing people, managing information about people. So it wasn't just, you know, some crude primitive peoples recording their crude primitive lives on, you know, cave art. That's not what was happening. So I want to just skip a little bit to page 6 of the introduction. We talked about this a little bit in our unrecorded chat, and I just want to mention that the Carolingians or Carolingians, it doesn't really matter to me how we say it, Merovingian, Carolingian, but these peoples, Alan is actually tracing this type of people. As Prince said, He was, he said, well, what I got out of there, what Alan is telling us is that we're really looking at two races of people, or perhaps we're looking at two races of people from the way that they are described. And so these aren't necessarily just tribes of the Franks, which are Germanic tribes, and that had a great influence on Europe, but they might come before that if we trace this type down through time. And so just as a really quick recap there, when we see them by that name, Merovingian and Carolingian, we've got the this is, I think, coming out around, say, 750 AD and lasting, or no, earlier than that. I don't think I have those dates in my head, but say 750 to 950. It's a little over 200-year period there. But we have the Merovingians, and then it seems that we have the Carolingians taking over. But Alan is explaining to Jackie that the Carolingians, or the Charles, he's helping you understand that name, Charles, Carol, Carl, that these were always the advisors, or the kind of the power behind the throne. So you have Merovingians, and then their advisors, who were called the mayors of the palace. And Charles Martel was a Carolingian, or mayor of the palace, and he was the one who gave gave the Catholic Church huge areas of land, which became known as the Papal States. And they were ruled by the Pope from like 1750-ish, 1756, I believe is the exact year, until 1870. And so much came out. What I came to think of as I studied deeper into it was a kind of standardization. You have the script, the font, the Carolingian minuscule, which harkened back to a legible, readable kind of font from antiquity, and this heavily influenced the printing press and the fonts that were used there. And we'll get into a lot of this as we go further along, and we're talking about Martin Luther and the Reformation and so forth. But one thing that struck me about Charlemagne and standardization was that he was even hands-on in the involvement of crafting the sermons. And this is really important because you're looking here at a system of control. So we don't just look at kings and their advisors, but we also have to look at the church. And of course, we're, about to watch the selection of a new pope. And we saw all of the heads of state, including Donald Trump, but all of the heads of state who went to see the funeral of Francis, Pope Francis. And so now these other names are being talked about, and it's just so interesting to see the Pope, even though our papal states have been ended for, some 160 years or so, being treated like a head of state. So interesting things there. So as we get into this, and Alan was knew that he was speaking to a Christian audience, I just wanted to say, remember what he says in this talk about not battling each other. At the intro, he said, I try not to offend too many people because, after all, you don't help people by coming down on their belief with a hard fist. You help people by getting inside and listening and in showing them other ways of looking at things. And this is a much better technique than going to war with them. And that's the traditional technique where people just battle each other and shout at each other across the room or the hall, no different than little boys in school washroom saying, my God is bigger than your God. So I was talking with Prince about this, and I was, reminding him of all that Alan said in that section about how the truth is supposed to lie within a person, and you must know yourself. And this is an important thing that ought to help us remember not to battle with each other, because we all have our own work to do on ourselves. But I had noticed on the Telegram channel that someone had someone posted, I know who it was, but I'll leave them nameless. They said, to know yourself is not enough because psychopaths and narcissists know themselves. They know they're bad or evil or devoid of natural humanity. And I said to Prince, I said, you have said that we have to be better. And where did you start with that? And Prince said, I had to learn how to forgive myself, just like I had to learn empathy for others. You start rewinding your life and looking at how you've been, the good, the bad, the ugly. Don't look for a deity or another person to forgive you. You're the one who has to forgive you. And we talked about a story. I reminded him of something that he had told me a few months ago. And I wanted him to talk to me about that story again. But those of you who heard his real histories will remember that he had a motorcycle and he liked, he's in his mid-70s, I think maybe even headed towards 77. But he liked riding around Las Vegas on his motorcycle and just looking at people, studying, observing, and whatnot when he wasn't busy gardening. And his motorcycle was stolen. Not that long ago, and I'll just say within the last year, because it was a whole process of him reporting that it was stolen and it was finally recovered, but it was really messed up. I mean, he said it just wasn't really his bike, but the police found who stole it. They set a court date. Prince saw the condition of the bike and he just wasn't interested in it, having it back. He wasn't interested in the court proceedings, but he was told that he was required to show up. And Prince said, I saw the guy sitting there and I felt empathy for him. The first thing I said to myself was, you've stolen from people. How do you think those people felt? So you really have to really sit down and be quiet and think about things, analyze yourself, forgive yourself and have empathy for yourself. And I think that is so true. It reminds me of conversations that I have had with Alan about the process of seeing what you've done in the past and seeing who you really are and how you could do better and so forth. I don't remember Alan's exact words, but it's really not about the, oh, I'm so bad, woe is me, mea culpa, and you get the whip out, the cat o' nine, and you start, doing the penance and all that. He just said, he said that itself then becomes a form of ego and navel gazing where you're just so obsessed with, yourself and your past and all that you've done wrong. You just need to look at it and do better, see it and move on. And I do like the idea that we have to start by forgiving ourselves, because I have found that if I don't do that in a situation, that it can make me a harsher judge of other people, because first one under the microscope is me. And usually by the time I have had that close-up look, I'm not that interested in the other guy's crimes against me. And there, it's a balance, because if you are dealing with a psychopath or a narcissist, you need to know and, hopefully run the other direction. So I talked to Prince about Alan's, comments about squabbling, and Alan goes on to talk about experiences. He said, so people are left to squabble and fight amongst themselves because everyone has a different experience going through life. Hopefully, I hope they do. Perhaps they should look at themselves, listen to themselves, think for themselves, because ready-made suits tend to get us in trouble. And he's talking about, religion is just one of those ready-made suits that we're happy to step into. And Alan said, people crave these experiences. And here he's really kind of talking about the paranormal, what we might call the spiritual experience. And he said they crave it. And he said, I've had those experiences, and I just don't put it down to, oh, it was this or it was that, because the books say so. Alan said, I just have the experiences and I note them. And I've had the experiences of paranormal, and I note them too. I don't run off and join a group and say, explain this to me and start chanting. Then I'll interject here with something that Prince said about that. He said, I just asked him about his experiences. I said, can you relate to that? And he said, yeah, my whole life it's been that. Nobody would understand my experiences. I can tell others, but they won't understand. And at the very end of the introduction, Alan is describing the this, he's likening that to the Matrix movies, where in the third one, in the final one, Neo Anderson, son of Anders, the new man, meets the grand architect. He's the grand architect of the universe. And he's in a room, and there's hundreds of TV screens there on the wall. And basically, the architect is showing Neo all of the different ways his life could go, but they've all been predicted, they've all been seen. Because they know, the grand architect knows Neo better than Neo knows himself. And Alan said, this is regarding seeking and knowing yourself. He said, for the person who wants to break through all this, you have to know yourself. You must know yourself so that you can find the answers, which the big boys cannot predict from you. This is the beginning of the journey. So that really is, it's looking within, because everything else has been gamed by the grand architect of the universe. Only that which comes from within, spontaneously, at knowing yourself, that's what cannot be predicted. And I know they've got all kinds of technology and thought reading this and that, but they aren't there yet. And so that is a big thing. So I asked Prince, what do you think the point of this system is? And Prince said, it's building your mind for you so you don't have to do it yourself, destroying your free will. Now think about that, the grand architects, because we're going to talk about Nimrod and the great encompasser, and there's throughout the Masonic techniques of building, the builder, the that which was left imperfect being perfected, and so forth. So again, Prince said, it's the system, the point of the system is building your mind for you so you don't have to do it yourself, destroying your free will. And then he said, the computer was given to you to destroy your individuality. If you're not an individual, you don't have a free will. Sure, there's good things on it, the computer, that is. That's part of the carrot. Nobody asks, though, where did this come from? Why is it here? And Alan had said something that I think is important for us as we go through this whole book club meeting and talking about He said, everything now, remember, this is 1998. Well, he's saying this is 2000 when he's seven, 2007 when he's writing the introduction, but still, that's even that is 18 years ago. He said, everything that happens today is very important for those who are able to cut through into the minds and the hearts of people. So spontaneity must come from the heart. And he goes on to describe it's an artificial system, a Kraft cheese sterile presentation system. And if I have time, I might touch on that regarding the Delphi technique. But this is it. I am hoping that in this group, in this book club, are people who can speak and convey what they're learning and share that with other people. And it's really important. Coming from our hearts and not from, the head heart combo, that's fine. But when you come from your ego, that is not so great. So again, Alan said, well, and maybe this is my way of saying it, but anything else, any other way of communicating is just ego. And then you're into my God is bigger than your God. Now, Andrea had suggested that because the waiting for the miracle transcripts is part one and part two, and part one has 12 interviews and part two has 12 interviews, she said it starts to be kind of confusing. We're on part one, interview one. She goes, it might be good to give them names. And I thought that was a great idea. And so here begins part one, interview one, which I have titled Consciousness is Knowing the Truth. And Alan said to Jackie, it's very sad that people live and die and they never know reality. And he had begun to think that the purpose of life is to come to full consciousness. And the enemy, of course, is trying to stop us from achieving that goal. And Jackie asked Alan how he would define full consciousness. And I'm just going to interject here and say, sometimes Jackie asks the question that I wish she would not have asked. That, I'm thinking when Alan said, I have begun to think that the purpose for life is to come to full consciousness, and the enemy, of course, is trying to stop us from achieving that goal. My first question would be, who is the enemy? But Jackie wanted to know the definition of full consciousness. And so Alan said, the truth, knowing the truth is the hardest thing to define. And one listener, I don't know if they're in this chat group today. I don't think that they are, but they are reading along with us, and they said, the Delphi technique, right off the bat in the first interview, Alan talks to Jackie about the Delphi technique, and he, this listener, said, I think it would be good if every single talk that we have a little bit of discussion on the Delphi technique. And it's interesting because Alan tells us there what he thinks about the Delphi technique. And it's not exactly the way that you're going to find a definition online or if you look at it. But Alan said the public are given a history. That's the story that we're given, somebody else's story. And he said, you'll find that the Delphi technique is where you train someone in a certain method, and then they train others who don't realize they're being trained, and they carry on the same technique, and then their parents and their parents before them are basically taught a similar method. So I've heard over the years Alan talk about the Delphi technique like being used in, real time in an auditorium when you have a meeting going on, but the way that you'll hear it defined often is a technique for a group of experts coming to a consensus about it's something that can be used to forecast. So this is used a lot in trend analysis and future predictions, even something like what Moore's Law about the shrinking or the chip in a computer getting smaller and smaller, and how many months does it take to do that, and so forth. So it's used in that way, but remember that we are the product that they are future casting or future forecasting. So we're constantly being managed by a group of experts. Well, what if we do this, this, and this, what's their behavior going to be? So it's something that we can all look at a little bit more on our own. But there's so much interesting stuff in this first interview getting into. He's describing the Merovingians, the Carolingians, the Hyksos, the shepherd kings, which are not from Egypt, but they turned themselves into pharaohs. And again, you have a different, this alien people. And then this was interesting to me. He's taking the Hyksos and the Amalekites and bringing them down through time into the Merovingian line and the Carolingian line. So I don't want anyone to feel overwhelmed. That's an important thing because there are a lot of books and a lot of information coming at us. But I think it's important to remember, to keep remembering all the time that what's being described here, what it, Alan is telling us about, is a system. It's a system. And, you know, in a recent talk that I posted, he said, don't be overwhelmed by data. And that includes books and texts and the some of the things that we'll talk about in this book club. He said, you've got to, if you spark to it, you know, if it enlivens you, if it quickens your mind, then that's the area, that's your own personal journey that you can go on. So we don't have to know everything to know the truth. And I think that's an important thing to remind ourselves. I said to Prince, you know, I said, on a real history that we did, you talked about how when you were younger, you went through a series of looking for external enemies, you know, blaming the white man, that kind of thing. And Prince said, yes, the white man was the cause of all of our evils. It's the white man's fault. But he has learned that everybody is being used. He said, it's easy to blame other people until you really look at yourself. Everybody's a willing fool. Even those who bring the agenda forth, everybody gets had. Nobody escapes. The only people that escape are those who can hold on to their individuality. Because without your individuality, you have no free will. You're being managed. You're being guided. You've complied. You've volunteered. And this is an interesting thing we can chew on. Prince said, the beginning has been written, the end has been written, in between is where everything and everybody, and then he just kind of drifted off and went to another thought, and I didn't want to interrupt his flow. He said, why don't people say no? Why don't people ask why? That's what got me in trouble. I'd say when I was young, why do I have to do that? And my parents would say, because I told you to. And Prince said it starts when you're born. They cut the umbilical cord too early. So the whole birthing process is where it starts. Not enough oxygen gets to the brain. People don't have all the human ability they could have. The elite have long known the advantage that oxygen gives a baby. And of course, you know, Prince was talking about that because he came to our unrecorded conversation prepared. And in this conversation that Alan was having with Jackie, she talked about a novel by Ira Levin, dystopian novel called This Perfect Day. And Ira Levin wrote Rosemary's Baby and a lot of other novels and things that you might recognize. But in that novel, This Perfect Day, they withheld oxygen for certain, you know, just didn't, just gave them just enough oxygen to live, but not enough so that their brains developed as they should have. And I mentioned to Prince that I had just recently done a real history with Andrew and Elizabeth in England, and I know that there have been part of the Telegram channel, and I didn't notice whether they were here for this talk or not, but we talked on the real history about Elizabeth's research into when she became a doula and studied midwifery or midwifery. And in that real history, she discussed, she had done intense research. She's quite the researcher. And she had done intense research on writings from all kinds of people. And she had discovered, you know, she read all of the usual suspects that Alan gave us, you know, Bertrand Russell, et cetera, and she discovered that the elite have long known the best form of childbirth, and hence they promoted the opposite. And that includes cutting the umbilical cord. And then, just as an aside here, Prince recommended a book that he had recommended to me before by Andre. It's a man, but it looks like Andrea, but it's, I think he's German, I'm not sure, but Andre Moritz, he is deceased now, but he wrote a book called Timeless Secrets of Health and Rejuvenation. And I looked it up, it looks interesting. And so I just mentioned that I had talked to Prince. I mentioned that to Andrew, and he let me know that after that real history, Nick of Hayes Reviews, who's got a baby boy on the way, had contacted them, and he ended up having a recorded conversation with them about natural childbirth, amongst other things. And I'll share that with you. It's very interesting. So I'm putting that in there because I like some of the the conversations that happen off the channel where people meet each other and in digital space and get to know each other and form relationships that are sharing valuable human knowledge and wisdom. So I think, let's see, what do I want to hit here? I mentioned earlier Nimrod, and this will come up again, and I think that it's possible down the road at some point that this is included more fully in the syllabus material. But Jackie and Alan talked about Nimrod, and Jackie said that one of Nimrod's titles is the one who created government. And Jackie said that the first title given to Lucifer was the king of Babylon. And Alan said that another title given to Nimrod was the encompasser, because he was the first to build fortified walls and towers and the Tower of Babylon. So some things there, the thing with Nimrod is you've got some blending of mythological characters and historical figures, and but essentially what we're looking at here is a type, one interesting, he's a hunter, but one interesting way that he is described is in a rebellion against God, but and th that fits how Lucifer is described as well. But again, encompasser, builder, and you've got the whole idea of Freemasonry and ultimately building you, building us. And another one of his titles was the first one who created war on his neighbors. That's a big title, but the first one who created war on his neighbors. And as Alan said, that's an important one. And another title was the first one to create the priesthood, which is a big part of controlling populations through fear and superstition. And that Alan and Jackie went on to discuss at length throughout the both of these first two interviews, the bloodlines of the elite and their intermarrying, interbreeding program. And Alan is explaining to her that the Darwins really only intermarried with the Wedgwoods, and there was a very selective breeding program that could be traced as far back as Plato. Plato writes about it in The Republic, a perfect society run by an elite who, through interbreeding the superior, become even more superior. And Alan mentions that another title of Nimrod was the keeper of the secrets of the ages. And so I mean, I think what is so amazing about this book, these transcripts, is that we really are seeing so many facets to this system. And one of the first books that I read when I was listening to Alan before I met him was Plato's Republic. I thought, well, he talks about this all the time, so I will read it. And it's a the dialogue, and they run through a series over and over and over of questions or possibilities, or what if we do this? And one that really struck me that I never forgot was the dialogue discussion on justice. And ultimately, after justice was hashed out, what is justice, et cetera, that the conclusion that was arrived at was that justice really doesn't matter, but the appearance of justice is crucial. And to me, that kind of described in a nutshell the way that we are managed. It's very deceitful, to say the least. Then later on, about page 14 of the first interview, they talk about Michael Cremo's book. And in the book, it's called Jackie calls it the secret archaeology. And this was an example of where, in transcribing it, I could have done better, because the book is actually called Forbidden Archaeology, and I could make a parenthetical note there. But Alan goes on to talk about Michael Cremo. It's very interesting that he said, in addition to forbidden archaeology, which basically the premise is human bones, that not showing a evolution from ape to human bones, but human bones go back, millions of years. This is his forbidden archaeology. But then Alan goes on to mention that another book well worth investigating is written by one Ian Taylor, who wrote In the Minds of Men, Darwin and the New World Order. And so what he said to Jackie regarding, see, they want you to think that in prehistory you've got these apes, and what Alan is saying is no, the skeletons that they've uncovered are exactly the same as modern man. Again, a very ancient system. And Alan said, we're being lied to on a big, big scale. They have determined one group of scientists who believe in a theory and everything must fit that theory. And they say that we found one or two ape men from the past. So, and he's showing why this is important for undermining Christianity. And an interesting thing here that he talks to Jackie about, they talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls and Benjamin Franklin's attack, his involvement in what you might think of as anti-Christian attacks. Franklin initiated in the Grand Orient Lodge of France Voltaire, who was considered one of the biggest enemies of Christianity at that time, and he presided over Voltaire's Masonic funeral. So what Alan is showing you and what he's telling Jackie is they give us these religions, and at the time that they decide it's time for a new religion, they begin to undermine it. And we're looking at a priesthood. And so if you say, oh, well, so and so is in the clergy, like he points out that both Malthus and Darwin come from clerical families, either father, grandfather, or multiple members of the family were in the clergy. So you're not really, I mean, at least the way that I interpret what he is saying and what I have read myself is you're not really looking at the son who said, oh, I don't want to go in the family business. And, you are a preacher and I rebel against that. You're actually looking at a clergy that's just a different clergy than we, it's a different priesthood. They have a different doctrine, their secret doctrine, if you will, that they are carrying down through time. So that's it. It's the architects. When one religion has done its work, they knock it down, they set up another. And there's a discussion that they have about the mystery schools. What are the mystery schools? Where do they come from? And Jackie said, when we talk about the mystery schools, what does that mean exactly, the mysteries? And Alan said, the mysteries are mysteries of the ages. It's really what they're called. He said, it's basically the technique of government. The technique of government and all the forms and necessary agencies that you need from military, priesthoods, to the civil service, etc. And Jackie said, in other words, controlling the people by fear and guilt. And Alan said, fear is the prime one. He's explaining without fear, you can't bring in armies. You've got to, fear makes people want to be protected. Jackie said, do you think this is part of what Jesus was doing? And Alan said, Jesus was definitely exposing it. He was taking the mysteries, in other words, these forms of control, these techniques of government, straight to the people. But he was only feeding them enough of what they could take at the time, knowing full well that they had been brought up like we are today with a given reality. And so this is what Alan is saying, and he is saying, he's talking about our understanding of a message being very different than what the message actually was. But, he's saying Jesus is exposing a system. And that leads us to the second interview, which I have titled A Few Would Be Chosen. And Jackie starts off with a discussion about a book that she had read, that she had gotten, she'd ordered, sent away for, called occult technology, the occult technology of power. And I mentioned that to Prince, and he's from Michigan, and you know, he said that he had sent away for it at that address, but he never heard back from anybody. And I found a PDF copy of it online. I printed it out 2 copies. I mailed one to Prince. I read one. We didn't have the book for our discussion, but my assessment of this, because Jackie talked to, she read sections of it to Alan. She talked to it for a bit, about it for a bit. And my assessment was that it was really a very entry-level basic primer that was likely written, you know, it's anonymous. So I think it was likely written or published by a Freemason or similar. In other words, it's just a limited hangout, a very limited hangout of the techniques of power. And they do this, you know, they've got to control both sides of the, you know, both sides. And the Delphi technique, I was reminded, somebody had sent me something that they wanted me to see. It was a talking head giving a video. I don't even remember what the subject matter was. And when I clicked to play it, it was muted. And I was going to go unmute it, but I got fascinated watching his body language and everything about him. And so I never unmuted it. I watched it for a few minutes. And what I realized that I was seeing was that whoever this talking head was, he was emulating the body language, everything about his gestures and so forth really looked like Charlie Kirk, who is a conservative talking head in the U.S. in his 30s, I think, young 30s. He was set up as a late teenager, you know, maybe at the age of 18 or so by a wealthy businessman. And now he, you know, he's shaking hands with Trump and promoting Trump and so forth. But this Delphi technique of giving you the experts, training them so that they come to a conclusion, they're forecasting our behavior. And then those are our opinions given to us. And that's where we go. So our behavior is predicted because it's being guided. But that was just kind of fascinating to me to see. We get so many types of people that talk to us. And so again, in this section, Alan talked about Darwin. The whole theory of Darwinism was to put man against the animals for social control by the elite. Thomas Malthus, who came up with the concept of overpopulation and the need to depopulate. And again, this is the point where he highlighted their connection to the clergy. And I think... I'll skip over to you. This is page 25. This is Jesus and Techniques, is the note that I've made here. Because Alan has talked to Jackie about Armand Hammer and, you know, he's working both sides of the communism, capitalism field, and just showing you how it's all run from the top. And Jackie's wanting to talk about, oh, I think they've underestimated the spirit of man and so forth, the spirit within us. And, you know, it's kind of that cheerleading bit there. And Alan said, well, I'm not so optimistic about people waking up. I think Jesus said that a few would be chosen. And then Jackie said, well, if we go back to the concordance, you know, maybe it was a few will be chosen. Maybe it's that a few would answer. And so there's that kind of back and forth that they have. And Prince and I were talking about, because what Alan is talking to Jackie about was Jesus told people how to manage the system, which is to help each other. And then we don't fall victim. We are not prey to the predators if we are willing to help each other. This is what has been given to us to know. And Prince and I talked about the homeless. He said that there are signs everywhere in Las Vegas that say, don't give anything directly to the homeless. Donate in this box. In other words, let the state take care of it. And I told him how when I was living in L.A., I had a big party one time, and I had some leftover chicken wings. And I mean, I'm talking some platters of chicken wings. And I thought, oh, well, let's just put that in the car with some bottled water and toilet paper. And, so I had a lot of, several cases of bottled water and some toilet paper and chicken wings. And I drove downtown to, where a lot of homeless people are in LA. And I began to give it to people. And within a few minutes, some official, somebody came over and said, you can't do that. And I said, well, why not? And they said, well, you have to have a permit. You can't do that without a permit. And we only give permits to authorized organizations. And I said, why? I mean, I said, I can understand that the chicken wings maybe is a, that's a food safety issue, but I don't understand why I can't give people bottled water and toilet paper. But, my lack of understanding was going to lead to, I don't know, some kind of citation or worse. So I just left with my bottled water and toilet paper. And that's the way it is. We're not supposed to help each other. And we're told this over and over and over. And so Alan is, they're having this discussion at the end here. And Alan said, Jesus came to open people's eyes for the ones who could have them opened. And Prince said, Jesus was a way shower, a walking, breathing example of how to live. And Alan was a way shower. He tried to show people the truth. He gave his life for it. Alan came here to do what he had to do. He was a walking, breathing, living example to people. That was his message. Anybody who wants to sacrifice their life for another person, that's up to them. Everybody has at least one person they would sacrifice their life for, or at least everybody should have somebody. And so Prince had talked about, how when he was young, why can't I? Why not? Why? And he said, if you truly understand, you have knowledge and you know why. So that is, hopefully, I have made it in under an hour there, and we have some time to discuss as a group. I am going to mute myself and see if anybody wants to join in. Thank you for listening.
Hi, Graham. Do you want to go ahead?
On you go, darling. I'll speak after you.
Thanks, Graham. I just wanted to talk quickly about the Delphi technique. You might know the classic understanding of it as a town hall meeting where they have speakers debating on a stage. And what they'll do is that they want the audience to leave with a particular understanding, so they'll plant members of their own into the audience who will then ask the pertinent questions that they can answer. And it's also designed to sort of block out opposition from the audience, from the natural audience. People must realize that in the modern age, the Delphi technique is happening on the internet, on TV, just on a much larger stage. So you'll have a Joe Rogan, and he'll invite Elon Musk on, and then somebody else will invite Elon Musk on, and Joe Rogan will have a couple of more guests. And what you'll find is that as a larger group, they are generating consensus without you really knowing. Sometimes they speak a little bit at cross terms with each other, but be aware of finding somebody fascinating or intriguing or just very entertaining, because it's not just about that particular person, it's who they talk to and what they talk about. And then they, as Melissa mentioned, it's about creating consensus on a grander scale. And everything today is global. You travel halfway across the planet, and people are generally discussing the same things, watching the same UFC fight that was on the last weekend. It's everything's become so global yet local. So watch out for these talking heads, these people who sound like they perhaps could be speaking for you. watch out. It's very often part of a larger, it is a larger Delphi technique, consensus generating activity. Yeah, that's it. Over to you, Graham.
Thanks, Darren. I think you made a really good point there about the information, certainly on the internet, but I suppose you could take in, you know, the press as well, the media. It is consensus building, and you see that in lots of articles today where they actually give you a question and answer session as part of the report, which is quite funny. And Alan, of course, links that back to the Republic, which is written in Plato's Republic, which is written in the same way. So it definitely is consensus building. You're brought to these conclusions, and you're also given your opinions by these talking heads. It's true. And I think, Melissa, I'd just like to thank you as well. I think Prince raised some excellent points there about the internet, and it's certainly something I'm aware of too. It's so pervasive with the information, and I think a lot of us, or certainly it seems like we think that all of our questions can be answered on the internet. And I think anybody who's listened to Alan for a while and read through the books that he suggested, you'll realise that some of the information that Alan talks about through this, and of course I've read this a number of times, you just won't get it. You won't get the confirmation from the internet, because one of the tools of this system is omittance of information, and that's how we're brought to our faulty conclusions. And so it is a tool which is running counter to being an individual. You mentioned that. And I think it's so difficult because we want quick answers. And so we're looking into the internet because it's really convenient for us. We can type in a few keyword searches and expect to have the answers, but it's not really there, to be honest. You've got to really dig in into the whole historical data. And I think, Melissa, you mentioned about I mentioned that Alan, that the pyramid is a perfect analogy of Alan's work, because it's true, because he has this such a wide base of knowledge. You know, you can tell as soon as I first listened to Alan, you can tell he's obviously read a lot of books. He tells you that over the years. But he's also been able to retain that information, which it's one of the things about reading lots of articles on the internet. I tend to not be able to recall some of that information, but if I read books, I can definitely recall more information, if you like. But Alan, he always takes it to a point, of course, and that you can tell that there's information in there that covers just probably hundreds of books and thousands of hours researching. And just in the first, just to touch on a few things, because, you know, the information with the Carolinians and the Merovingians, it is there. There is tons of information, and we actually live about 2 kilometers from an ancient monastery. It's called Lorsch Abbey, Lorsch Monastery. And so Charlemagne was a frequent visitor there. It was his palace, if you like. It was his monastery. So it's not too far from Aachen. I think it'd be a couple of days travel, 2 or 3 days travel in ancient times. It's a couple of hours travel now. So he was a frequent visitor here. So you can see the stamp of the Carolingians all over here. But it is interesting that Alan, even though Jackie's jumping around so much in the first interview, Alan still has a thread And he actually brings in so much information, and you see this vast knowledge of information really shining through. And the Merovingians and Carolings is certainly worth a study to dig into, but it's so vast, it's so intricate. But I'm just going to touch on a few things. The name Merovingian really means, it's Mer, means the mother. And Vingian is a vine, so it means the mother of the vine. So it's divine, because they're divine kings, they're divine rulers, if you like. And Alan, again, he goes through and he takes in the star sign Virgo, because this is very important. I know I don't want to jump too far ahead, because Alan is right, it is a form of deprogram that he's going through. And that Virgo is important. And there's two star signs in Virgo. It's our hands. And one of them is Vindimatrix, which also means mother of the vine. Vine, the matrix. Matrix is mother. But the other hand is called Posta Verta. And that means goddess of childbirth from Rome. She was the goddess of childbirth. So here you go. You've got the breeding program coming in here. And it's also very important. And so then Alan goes through these names, this line of Charles, yeah? And he goes into Charles Darwin. Again, we're back at the breeding program with the wedge roots and the Huxleys. And so this Carolingius, this line of Carol is interesting, because he takes in the name Nazarite or Nazareth. And in the Lorsch Abbey here, the founding myth is that the bones of Saint Nazarius is why he was a martyr. He was one of the Christian martyrs. And that's why this Lorsch Abbey was built on the bones of Saint Nazarius. That's the myth. And that word is very important. Alan goes into it in, I think, maybe interview 5 or 6 or 7. And he does repeat this word Naza and Nazai, and how it's connected to the Nicene code. So we have Roman Catholicism coming in here. And the word Nicaeus was actually a nickname for Jupiter, if you look into that. And of course, the pagan temples of the temples of Jupiter, the temples of Venus, have been found all over what you would call ancient Gaul or the ancient Frankish land. And Clovis was called, he's really the first Carolingian. He was called the new Constantine. And this name is very important, Clovis. In German, it's Chlodwig or Ludwig, or in French, it's Louis. So these names are very important, because Alan tells us that terminology is so important to lead us around in circles. But they actually show you the key. And that's one of the meanings of the word Clovis, or the name Clovis. It means key. Clavus means key in Latin. And it also means nail, clavis, clavus and clavis. And you know, with the French kings, I think somewhere in the region of 18 or 19 French kings were named Louis. And of course, Charlemagne's, I think it was grandsons, who was reported to be the last Carolingian king, was Ludwig. I think it was Louis the Pious or Louis the German or something. But it's Ludwig. It's the same names. You'll find that out. But then Alan even brings in Franklin, yeah? Benjamin Franklin, and that's tied right back to the Merovingians, because they come from the Franks. And Franklin, the line of Frank, means the land owner of free but not noble birth. Yeah, so he's a worker bee, really. And it is interesting when you look into the word Frank, because it comes from the French Francus, which means free, or Francalis, which means held without Jews. And of course, in the English, the franc is really a signature ensuring conveyance without charge. And it was really a social passport at that time. So I think you made the point, Melissa, that these tribes were not just some savage, barbarous tribes. They were a highly organized military class, and certainly the Franks, they were trained literally from young to be a military class. They were trained to ride horses and use lances. So you'll find that out. But the word Frank, of course, is free in French, and that's the name Franc-maçon in French, or as you would spell it in English, Franc-maçon is the word for Freemason. That's what a Freemason is called in French. So these words are very interesting, and of course Alan's got this in his mind. And of course then he takes in the Knights Templar, and they're all connected, because the Knights Templars, the skull and bones, is really is an ancient Frankish symbol. And that's, you'll find that, I mean, we've got tons of old German books here that we've been reading through. And of course, we've visited the Lorsch Abbey. And you see all these symbols, and most of it's been taken away now. They really want to eradicate any kind of historical reference. You can see that. And of course, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site today. So Alan takes in the Templars and the Sassani, an ancient Egyptian tribe of assassins, and that's where you get the word assassin. It's also where you get the word hashish, because that's the drug. They would take psychedelic drugs before they would go on slaughtering the lands. So then Alan, you mentioned it, Melissa. Alan takes in the mysteries. What are the mysteries? Yeah? Well, they're formed, the techniques of government, how to rule the people. And in the Lorsch Abbey, you'll see the architecture. It's stunning. I'll maybe post some pictures of some of the pictures I've taken. But you'll see this, the hexagram sign, the hexagram symbol all over. And this is an ancient, ancient symbol for the beehive. This is the honeycomb. We're back to the breeding program again. And remember, another line of Carl, or Charal, or Charl, is Carl Quigley. And he told us that the European Union was to be based on a loose base of a Holy Roman Empire. And of course, he didn't fill in the blanks for you. You had to fill it in yourself. And it is interesting because these sites, these monasteries, the Carolinian monasteries, or palaces, were all built on ancient military Roman sites. So I find that interesting. And Alan, of course, takes this all in what he's telling you, even though Jackie's bouncing around. But yeah, there's so much to this, so much to it. But I'll let somebody else come in now, if you like.
I appreciate your a contribution, Graham. That's terrific. And I just wanted to mention too, you know, Graham said that he's read the book quite a few times. And yes, he has, because Graham and Gabriella translated Waiting for the Miracle into German. And that has been available on the website for some many months now. But yes, so they it's available in German because of Graham and Gabriella. Thank you. And I wanted to mention super quickly, there was something that I had made a note that I wanted to mention, and I forgot to. This was about where Alan was talking to Jackie about Darwin and the theory of evolution and so forth and so on. And she asked if he'd ever read Zachariah Sitchin's work. And, you know, so this, I just want to mention, this is in the syllabus material. This is the whole ancient astronaut idea that was put forth by a fraudster and picked up, you know, well, Sitchin says he got it from the cuneiform, and, you know, as Alan said, This is one man with his own unique, very peculiar take on the cuneiform coming up with this. And this has gone kind of down through time in recent history. There's always someone that's picking this up and promoting it. And a more recent one was David Icke. So this is an important component for the gatekeepers or the start gatekeepers to have us think that we're not created. We come from somewhere out there that's not created. And, we're either that or we're just animals. But I would love it if somebody else has something to say about anything. Thank you for participating, all of you.
Could I add another bit? Just looking at the, Jackie asks, how would you define full consciousness? And you raised it already, Melissa. But those who have read a lot of Alan's material and highlighting, Graham was touching on language and how it's all connected. But what is this thing being awake and consciousness? What is it? Our language gives us clues of what it is. If you take the word know, what is your brain actively doing to be conscious? It has to be taking note. It is noting things. It's seeing something and cognizing it, feeding it back where the brain takes note. Just note. You make a note. That is what consciousness, that's what leads you to building up enough notes to be dialed in properly and to understand the world around you. A lot of people go through life where they're not really paying attention. So they don't take note. They don't notice anything. People who have been, you could say, awake from a young age, would have regularly seen or noticed around them how little people in their company are taking in the surrounding environment. And you can be with some people where you actually have to physically almost stick your finger out and point out certain aspects to something that is happening right around them. They simply don't see. It's like they're walking around with their eyes almost shut, and it's quite staggering. This little trick of language to know, is to note, to make a mental note, to notice, notice. So your third eye or your eye is your brain. It's your consciousness. So it's to note with your conscious mind. And then obviously memory would fall in there. So one way to sort of help somebody in your circles to possibly see something is to help them to notice something or to try and give them a hint at making a mental note of something. And you can actually maybe, if you're having a walk with somebody, you can start asking them, what do you see around you? And just get the person to feed back what they are seeing simply in their immediate environs, you can't expect somebody to understand what's going on if their brain is literally in a state of being asleep. It doesn't know how to work. It doesn't know how to take note. I think that's also something to bear in mind, to have a little bit of patience with people that can't seem to grasp something. They need to be shown a little bit about how to literally take note of where they happen to be. I just wanted to say that.
I'll say a quick word if I may. I missed the last week's unrecorded version. Introduced myself, Andrew, listening with Elizabeth, who sat next to me. But I watched a film a couple of years ago. I'll talk a little bit on genetics and the inbreeding thing. Something, a couple of things caught my attention. It was a modern version of The Wicker Man set in Sweden called Midsummer. And it's an ideal kind of pagan Viking midsummer celebration that some numpty gets invited into. But he discovers there's an inbreeding program where they have a kind of retarded individual kept in a shed making complete abysmal art drawings, and then the high priests decode them for everybody. Now, I saw an example of how to make gigantic pineapples at some point. And in the breeding program of genes, you separate the pineapples and you inbreed the smallest ones with the smallest ones, and you repress this gene for, I don't know, 5, 6, or 7 generations or something like that. And then you breed the cousins back in with each other, and you get a rebound effect where those smallest pineapples bounce back into the biggest pineapples. So to grow a gigantic vegetable, you have to separate the genes and force them in the opposite direction, like pushing a cat off of the edge of the sofa. You lean into it and then let your hand go away and it falls off in the opposite direction. Well, it raised the question with this film Midsummer, that if you were to take cousins and breed stupid people with stupid people for 6 or 7 generations and then blend them back in together, you might get the super high IQ suddenly rebounding. I'm not a geneticist, so I don't know all the expertise of it, but that forced formation of cousining, separating cousins deliberately and pulling them back together at a certain stage, caught my attention as an interesting thing to think about. And I'll let you respond. I have to chip off in a minute to collect my daughter from work, so I needed to say that quickly. But yes, something to think about.
Well, thank you, Andrew. I'm glad that you're there, and Elizabeth too. That's great. And anyone else in the group, because I do think I don't want to put pressure on anybody, but we were trying to keep our recordings a little tighter. But I'd still love to hear from you if you've got something that you want to contribute or in anything at all. Please do pipe up.
We had a crossover there. I'm just going to take the mic. Howdy. Hope everyone's having a good day. It might be a little loud from my end because I'm on a busy highway, but I didn't catch the entire conversation. I've been dealing with the house and the 7 month old, but I have listened to the entire first disc of Waiting for the Miracle, and a lot of what I picked up Alan was talking about was language and how the priests would come on down from high, or they would live inside of caves and stuff. So he had mentioned troglodytes, and a lot of that really gets your brain thinking, gets my brain turned in a different direction. And what I've been asking myself and questioning recently is basically where and when did language come from? And then obviously before language was ever a thing, that's gonna be like prehistoric, especially talking about like written language versus spoken language, and everything was an oral tradition before that. And I feel like the language probably surrounds money, or some kind of economic thing. I don't know too much about it. But I am fascinated with etymology and language, especially the word compassion, C-O-M, it's C-O-M, yeah. It's with, and passion, or passio, is to suffer. So I think that's a pretty interesting word, because most people think a passion is something pleasurable or something that you would desire. But being compassionate for someone, it often means you have to be willing to, I guess, what Melissa said earlier is to die for somebody. Other than that, I'm just still trying to figure out, I guess, how important language is as a technology. And then this system of control, Alan mentioned a lot about it's like what he was talking to a lot of Christians and such, the audience, but he did say that it was more about like he's examining a control structure. I feel like that's what he's always trying to point out. I think of things like a construction worker, because that's what I've done most of my life. And I feel like he was always pointing out like the engineers and the architects, and then like the scaffolding and the framework, like the most essential aspects of this power structure that we're dealing with. It's got millennia behind it, and we don't know how old it is, and we never will know the truth, but it's fun to hear other people's insights on the book and to get a group surrounding the content. I took a gander at the syllabus. It looks awesome. I don't have any notes. I'm just speaking off the cuff here, but these are just some of the thoughts that I have when I'm listening to Waiting for the Miracle and reading it. And definitely is really weird that there's like these weird troglodytes that would write down the genealogy of generations on these standing stones, and that it was like it's a science that the nobility used to, maybe, I don't know, breed these imbeciles, and then they'll eventually get a genius out of a batch. But I did, if Andrew was talking about the same movie, I think I did see that same movie, Midsommar. It's really creepy, and especially since we're in that time of year right now, how they all dance around a pole, and I think there's a lot of different symbols and messages in that, but I think it's mostly about twisting people's ideas around a singular point, because I think that ideas are like one of the most powerful things there are. It's just an idea, and you got to have language to insert ideas into other people's minds. So that's all I have.
Thank you, Jared. That's interesting. I really like that last bit too, about twisting ideas around a pole. That you know, and it really does actually come up with a kind of a uniform idea there. So thank you. I think that it's probably time. I didn't have since we got delayed starting because of tech difficulties, I don't have an exact start time, but I really do think that we have hit our hour and a half mark. And I just wanted to thank you all so much for being here. I'm just going to tell you right now that as the time drew closer for discussing this material, I got more and more intimidated. You know, I mean, it's Alan's work, and it's just so detailed on every page, everything he talks to Jackie about. So I've thrown myself into it heart and soul, and I appreciate you all being here, and I can feel how much thought and energy is going into this and love of the material. And I appreciate that deeply. I think this is going to be a lot of fun and very educational for me to do this. So this is the plan. Now, if we have to rehash it because it's not going to work with everybody, the plan is that we're going to meet every Saturday afternoon. Now, unfortunately, when our starting time is like 2 a.m. in Australia, so not everybody can do this. I don't know. We think of another time, but it's close to 1 p.m. my time, and I think it must be around 8 p.m. in England or UK. I'm not really sure where you all are and what time it is, but it's getting late for people. But next Saturday, we would have an recorded discussion on part one, interview three, which is Ancient Priests, is the title that I've given it. And interview four, which is A Contest Since the World Began. And there's a lot of great material in there. We're going to talk about the pyramids, Horus, Isis, the Khazars, the 13th tribe, the fifth man, genetics, bloodline, Russian Jews versus Sephardic Jews, all of that fits in here. And then classes of people and initiates, the Magi, the importance of the number 12. History begins at Sumer. And ancient societies, which we briefly touched on, Skull and Bones, and Mithraism, and so forth. So there's a lot of material that we can talk about. And that's kind of what we're hoping to do, that when we meet at the unrecorded session, we can talk about what we want to cover in the syllabus material. And that also includes other talks of Alan's. And I will get a schedule that people can sign up for if they want to be involved in contributing to the talks. And that will be up on the Telegram site too. So this is, last opportunity to say that important thing that's burning at the top of your skull, and then we'll cease the recording. So thank you.
Hello. I just wanted to say to Darren that the UFC fight was really...
David, hi. I caught a bit about...
I was just making a joke that the UFC fight was really good.
Oh, right.
Well, I don't want to watch it again. It's too violent.
Yeah. The UFC is the modern version of the gladiator fighter of Rome. It's that basic instinct entertainment to keep everyone occupied with circuses and
bread. Yeah, you're quite right. Yeah. Everybody's talking about it. It drives me insane.
I didn't hear about it until you mentioned it, so don't call me everyone. I don't even know what you're talking about. I just know it's funny, and maybe seeing Conor McGregor get his butt beat by the Muslim dude, I think that was one of the only ones I'll ever remember, but he shouldn't have talked so much smack.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd just like to say thanks to Melissa as well.
David, and thank you all. And I just I'm looking here at everyone who's here, and I just appreciate it. I'm happy that you're here. Like I said, this is something, an ongoing conversation that I am really looking forward to. So I appreciate it. This has been fun. Thank you. Please come back next Saturday at the same time, and we've got the syllabus material. We'll pin this at the top of the channel so that you can see it, and I'll put it later, probably tomorrow, on the website. This is the syllabus for part one, interviews 1-12, that I have done with Laura. So Laura and I have together made this syllabus, and we're working on the second half, which will probably be a few more weeks before we publish that. But there's lots of material and lots of different avenues that we can go down in discovering and uncovering and thinking about language. Very, very important. And, so anything that catches your fancy, I think, can be part of the conversation. And there should be, on these unrecorded sessions, there should be more time for contribution from all of you, because we're not, presenting the material. We're just talking about all of the, syllabus add-ons. So if there's nothing else, I'll thank you, Darren. I don't know if there's something that you want to say, but I'll say thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Melissa, and thank you, everyone, for your comments and your time. It's been great. Thanks.